contribution to me. Each day after a day of meditation, your legs are very sore, your bottom sore, your back sore, but hopefully your head, your mind is happy. So find a nice place to sit so you can enjoy the question session. Again, just you can write these questions on pieces of paper so they're anonymous. And remember that it's wonderful to be able to share your questions with others. It's very often that your question will be other people's question as well. It's something which one may have said or did not say during the morning talk, which comes to your attention, which is important for your practice of meditation. And so it's great to ask that question. And as I think I mentioned on the first talk, even if it's a question of which you know the answer, but you think that other people would enjoy or benefit from the answer, but you ask the question anyway. You ask the question not for your own benefit, but for the benefit of others. So those are the reasons to ask those questions. As I said at the Sangodi Vihara yesterday, if you don't ask questions, you'll be stupid in the next round. Okay, the first question is, okay, it's very good. Could you please explain how walking meditation is done? In walking meditation, we try and make it as similar as possible to the sitting meditation. Another question, please. We try and make it as similar as the sitting meditation. In the walking meditation is a practice you will see it performed in forest monasteries. Maybe you come to my monastery, every monk stuff has its own chankamas. I think if you go to places like Mitragala, you'll see the chankamas on every hut. In the retreat centre which I'm building in Perth, we're putting a lot of funds into making sure there is at least three halls for walking meditation. So on the retreat that everybody has the opportunity to alternate their meditation from walking to sitting, from walking to sitting. Because it's important that your body does not get too stiff and uncomfortable. If there's too much pain in your body, you find it very difficult to meditate. And remember what the Buddha did before he sat under the Bodhi tree. That he had a shower, the words a good bath. He had a very good meal, and famous milk rice, which was cooked for heavenly beings. And then he got some grass and put it at the root of the tree to make a nice cushion for himself. So he understood the need for physical comfort without indulgence for the practice of deep meditation. And if you are practicing meditation all day, you will get sore in your body. So it's great to be able to alternate and do some walking meditation as well as sitting. And how one does walking meditation, one tries to find a path, a simple path, with few obstructions, so one can walk backwards and forwards. By walking backwards and forwards, one hasn't got a destination, so it's not complicated. You find a path, you walk forward and then back, forward and back, forward and back. In a forest or in a park, you can just put your two shoes, one on one end and the other at the other end of the path, just so you know where to start and where to stop. In other words, you choose a nice, simple walking place. The length of the path depends upon how much space you have. Some monks like short meditation paths, some like longer ones. Some of the ones we have in our monastery are about 18 metres long, and even some monks, they can increase that another few metres. Others are only about 10 metres long, or 8 metres. Wherever you have an opportunity, you can always walk even just a few metres. And as you do the walking meditation, you start at one end. You usually put your gaze about 2 meters in front of you, not looking to the left or looking to the right, with your eyes open. The reason for that is by 2 meters in front of you, you can actually see where you're walking. So if there's any obstruction, just like a snake or a branch of a tree or some ants, you can always avoid it. It gives you the sense of security when you're just looking 2 meters in front. But it doesn't disturb you because you're just looking at mostly an empty path. And as you start walking, you walk naturally, not too fast, not too slow. However, you feel like walking. Sometimes if you're very tired, bit of fast walking will be good, just to get the body and the circulation moving. If you're very peaceful, then just slow walking is usually natural. If you have some indigestion, sometimes fast walking again gets the stomach moving and the bowels moving. It really depends on your state of body, whether you walk fast or whether you walk slow. But just as in sitting meditation, which I've taught here, there are stages. And the first stage of the sitting meditation is called present moment awareness. And we do that with walking meditation as well. The first stage of walking meditation is present moment awareness. So as you walk naturally from one end of your designated path to the other, you always make the first goal to be in the moment. So you don't allow the mind to start drifting into the past or into the future. You keep it present with whatever is happening now. So it's as if you are putting two guards on your mind. One guard is facing towards the past. So if any past events, memories or acts try and get in, the guard stops them getting in. And the other guard is facing the opposite direction, the future. So if anything from the future wants to try and get in, it stops it. Have you ever seen the photographs of like the presidents and the prime ministers of our world? You can always tell who are the bodyguards, because they're always the people not looking at the prime minister or the president, looking the opposite directions. And that's what we mean by the two guards, the security guards, keeping out the past, which robs you of your peace. Keep out the future, which again terrorizes the mind with fear and expectations. So when you keep those two out, when you're walking, just in the present moment, so when you've achieved enough present moment awareness, you're just here and now, then you can go on to the next stage, which is you get silence. So you pay extra attention to your mind to make sure you're not having a commentary while you're walking. You're not thinking. You're not having some solving some great problems in your life. Nor are you contemplating the Dhamma and thinking about dependent origination and the meaning of the universe. But you're silent, you're calming the mind down. And once you have not perfect, but pretty sufficient present moment awareness and silence, and I'll tell you what sufficient is in a moment, then you just start to not watch your breath. If you're doing sitting meditation, watch your breath go in and out. Now you watch your feet. Which foot is moving? The left foot or the right foot? So the focus of your attention becomes the walking itself. It's not just the attention on the feet, it's the lower part of the leg as well, to see the whole movement of the feet. As if you were a dancer, having to pay full mindfulness to the way that you walk. Or as if you were walking on a tightrope. You have to be very mindful of the way you step, because if you miss your step, then you fall a great distance and kill yourself. So be very aware as you are walking. You know which foot is moving, first of all. And the amount of present moment awareness and silence which you need is that which is sufficient to be able to watch the feet move left and right, left and right, left and right, without being too distracted. Because if you haven't suppressed the mind wandering off into the future and the past, if you haven't suppressed the thinking mind, you start watching the feet move left, right, left, right, and then you'll be off on some tangent thinking about all sorts of weird stuff. So first of all, we just suppress the past and future, we suppress the thought, to give us enough focus so we can watch feet moving left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, without being too distracted. After we watch the feet move, it's a natural progression to the next stage, which is the full awareness of the feet, similar to the full awareness of the breath, where we see the beginning of the left foot, the front move, or the left step rather. You notice which part of the foot moves up from the ground first. Whether it's your toe, the ball of the foot, the heel, the side step, whatever. So you become very aware of how a natural step begins and how it develops. And you find all these movement sensations in the legs and that foot until finally the foot is lowered onto the ground once more. You even notice what part of the foot touches the ground first, what part touches the ground last, and how the weight of the body now goes onto that foot to free the right foot to move. So you start to notice all the sensations of each foot moving. So it's no longer just left, right, left, right, left, right. It's a very refined awareness which fills the whole mind of the feet lifting up and going forward. You don't say these things, you just notice them. And there's a smooth flow of different feelings just in one step. And you'll be amazed just how interesting that can be as you become aware of the muscles contracting and expanding, pulling the feet up and away, down, as you walk from one end to the other. Once you have the full awareness of walking, the next step, again, so similar to breathing meditation, is what I call the beautiful step. You'd be surprised as that you fill the awareness with the feelings of each step. Those feelings become so fascinating and so beautiful and delightful. You become quite absorbed in just walking. It's so satisfying that it draws you in, and you go into a state of samadhi where you cannot be, you cannot hear sounds outside of you. The thinking tends to stop. You're completely engrossed in just the process of walking. And to give you an idea from my own experience, the first year I was a monk, was actually I was ordained in Bangkok. I did walking meditation on the veranda of one of the temples. And after the morning meeting, I always used to do 1 hour of walking meditation. I knew it was 1 hour because it took me 1 hour, half an hour, to go from one end of the hall to the other, and another half an hour to go back again. It was so slow. One day I was very, very peaceful. So peaceful, I hadn't finished the hours walking yet. But I forgot I'd been invited to a dharma. And because they were waiting for me, the senior monks sent another junior monk to come and get me. And I always remember this because my head was down 2 meters in front of me. And so happily just watching the feelings in the feet. Just a happy little monk. And then I heard, as if 1,000 miles away, this monk shouting out, "Brahma one soul, Brahma one soul." His mouth was right next to my ear. But because I was so still and so peaceful, that's what it's like. You're so in a beautiful, still, peaceful world. "Brahma one soul, you're late for the dharma." When I realized what he was saying, I realized I had to do something. And it took me such a long time to actually to move my head. Because every movement of the head was so fascinating to watch. And it took me about 2 minutes to move my head. Maybe 3 minutes. Like this, but I'm really exaggerating this. It's much faster than I did at the time. And I looked at this monk and said, "What? It's so hard to come out of stillness without enjoying it so much." And that's what happens with the walking meditation. That's about as far as you can take it, the beautiful step. You can't get into jhana or get nimittas when you're walking meditation, because if you do, you lose all awareness of your body. No, one of my friends who's a monk in Thailand said he did know one forest monk who would get into jhana while he was walking meditation. But the poor monk kept on walking into trees and into bushes. He had bruises all over him. Because you don't feel anything when you're in the mind. So it's not a good thing to do to get into jhana when you're walking. That's the only monk we've ever heard of. I've never seen it myself. So that's how one does the walking meditation. What that means is that you can still get a very, very deep state of samadhi while you're walking. And you don't have to worry about the aches and pains in the body. is a very healthy balance, because there's many doctors here. If you sit for too long, it's actually bad for the body. You do need to walk sometimes. So on a retreat like this, if it's all possible, and you get a bit stiff, or get a bit tired, see if you can find a little place to do walking. I haven't explored the space. I've got a nice little place where I can open the door between, I think, what is the walking vestibule and my room. I can do a nice walking meditation there. It's very, very wonderful. So if you can find a place to do walking meditation, just outside, or where else can I do walking meditation? Near the corridors? Out in the garage is a good place. And I really encourage that. It really helps. It means you're not disturbing the calming of the mind. You're just continuing the process of calming, but in a different posture. So does that make sense to everybody? Is there any comment you'd like to make about that? Yes. That's wherever they're comfortable, wherever you can forget about. I know that I've seen monks do different postures with their hands. What I used to do, sometimes, especially when I became an abbot, I did need to sort of figure out some problems about the monastery. Sometimes walking was a very good way of clearing the mind and seeing what I needed to do. And so I developed the way that if I had my hands in front, that was like calm, and I would not think. I would just put my attention on my feet. If I needed to think about a problem with the monastery or make some decisions about the monks, I'd put my hands behind and walk that way. So the different positions of my hand would instruct my mind that this was a time for concentrating or the time just for being peaceful. So that's what I did. But for yourselves, you can put your hands in whatever position you find them comfortable. And there is no magic position. So you can make the choice yourself whether you want to put them in front, behind, or by your side.
Yes.
Oh, that's very strange. I think if you don't turn around, what will happen is you'll probably get so concerned about where you're walking when you can't see. But that will give you a sense of inattention which will not allow the mind to become peaceful. So it's much better to turn around and walk naturally. Because people in real life never walk backwards unless they're crazy people. So it's good to turn around. Because otherwise you don't know what you might be walking into. Now can you tent? And attention is what will disturb the peace. It's the same as sometimes people say you should close your eyes when you're walking. If you close your eyes when you're walking, again, it's the same thing that you cannot see where you're going. And that again will make you tense. The Nama Rupa, not yet. Because the Nama Rupa, many people don't even know what the Nama Rupa is. And there's a lot of confusion with that term. Because the way the Buddha used Nama Rupa is not the way the Abhidhamma defines Nama Rupa. And because of that, you know, in monasteries there's a lot of discussions and even arguments about what that term really means. Now the biggest one is that in the suttas it's very clear that Nama Rupa did not include consciousness. In the Abhidhamma, the Nama includes consciousness. And that may seem just a technical point, but when you really start contemplating things, it is an important point. So it's just being complex. It's much better to become calm first of all, and contemplate later, after the jhanas. In fact, there is a very powerful teaching of the Buddha, which is in the Anguttara Nikaya. And the Anguttara Nikaya, one of the sections of suttas which the Buddha taught. There's so many suttas in there that many people, they're short suttas, many people neglect the Anguttara. Even now that you know that what has been translated into English, the modern version, you've got a good translation of the Diga, good one of the Matthew, a good one of the Sangita. We haven't got a good one of the Anguttara. Everybody's supposed to be working on it. It would be wonderful when we have that translation available for everybody. Because there's great teachings in there. The teaching I remember was they said they had the three obstacles to developing samadhi. Once those three obstacles, I won't mention those, they're quite obvious. Once those three obstacles are overcome, the last obstacle before you attain samadhi, the last one that you have to overcome, is called Dhamma Vitakka, which is contemplating Dhamma. I'm not talking class, I will not talk in class. One of the reasons why a teacher does that is not just to punish you, because it's like a conditioning. It's a brainwashing you. Not every time you write that, you have to look at it. It's like telling yourself 100 times, I will not talk in class. And it has an effect on you. So when you say, I will die that for sure, I will die that for sure. Very often, like an insight comes up, an awakening. That's true. And you see it in a depth you've never seen before. You know it's working when you get terribly afraid. You realize, my goodness, I am going to die at any time. Usually you face that fear, and once you get past that fear, you feel so peaceful. Actually, it's quite nice in becoming enlightened. It's almost like his last trick to stop you getting into samadhi. You're right at the door of jhana, as if he says, I'm not going to be able to stop him with thoughts about sex or cricket or food or anything else. Let's try and make him think of Dhamma instead. Because you know that if you get into jhana, then you're very, very close to enlightenment. But thinking about Dhamma before you have the jhanas, you think you're getting somewhere, but you're not. So when you get into deep states of meditation, don't contemplate Dhamma until after jhana. It's very, very tempting. Because for a while you think you're getting some insight and seeing things. But you're not seeing the real ones. That's why the last obstacle to overcome in this sutra in the Anguttara Threes is Dhamma Vitakka. Contemplating Dhamma. Don't do it yet. Do it after samadhi, not before. Can you use the word Buddha when you're doing walking meditation? Yes, this gets into the realm of using mantras. I haven't mentioned this yet. Mantras is words which you use together with your breath or together with the steps, left, right, left, right. You can use. This is a northeast Thai mantra, Buddha. So when you breathe in, you say to yourself, Bud, breathe out, toe, Bud, ho, Bud, ho. Or when you're walking, the left foot, Bud, right foot, toe, Bud, ho, Bud, ho. All it does is give you something more to occupy the mind with as you're breathing or as you're walking. However, that is just like a support to be used for the time being. When the mind is calm enough, even when you're watching the breath, you should stop all the Buddha business and just watch the breath silently. Once you've got in contact with the feet, the steps, you can let go of the Buddha and just watch the steps. However, there was another Thai mantra which was used for the walking, which we found very, very good in Australia. The Thai words were, when you move the left foot, you said thigh, right foot, nair. What it means is, in English, as you move the left foot, you say to yourself, I will die. Use the right foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. That is very effective, because we all know we're going to die. Superficially. On the surface, intellectually we know that, but emotionally sometimes we don't realize it fully. And as you do the walking meditation, I will die, that's for sure, right? I will die, that's for sure. If you repeat that to yourself 100 times, 200 times, 300 times, after a while the message gets in. I don't know if you went to school at the time when if you misbehaved, you had to write lines. I will not talk in class. I will not talk in class. I will not talk in class. One of the reasons why a teacher does that is not just to punish you, because it's like a conditioning. It's a brainwashing you. Not every time you write there, you have to look at it. It's like telling yourself 100 times, I will not talk in class. And it has an effect on you. So when you say, I will die, that for sure, I will die, that for sure. Very often, like an insight comes up, an awakening. That's true. And you see it in a depth you've never seen before. And you know it's working when you get terribly afraid. You realize, my goodness, I am going to die any time. Usually you face that fear, and once you get past that fear, you feel so peaceful. Actually, it's quite nice to know you're going to die, that's for sure. You don't have to worry about so much. You don't have to worry about paying the bills. You don't have to, because, you know, the insurance is going to take care of that afterwards once you get. You don't have to worry about all these other plans you have. Well, if you're going to die, there's more than you worry about. So it actually does help you detach and let go of things. I will die, that's for sure. So that's a nice mantra to use with the walking meditation as well. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. It's a bit too long to use while you're watching your breath. It certainly works when you're walking meditation. So again, when you're watching the breath, there's other mantras you can use as well. Pudho is one. The one which I like to teach people in Australia, because many people there think too much. As you breathe in, you recite shut. As you breathe out, up. Shut, up, shut, up. Not a lot of opportunity to shut up. Okay, let's do the next question. Venerable Sir, please explain Sama Sankalpa, and please also explain going to past or future, creating will and craving. Thank you. Okay, the Sama Sankalpa is the second factor of the Eightfold Path. I did mention it last night. It's important this morning. It's a very important factor which gets neglected, because the second factor of the Eightfold Path is Nekama Sankalpa, Hawaii Path Sankalpa, and what those mean, sankha means like your inclination, your planning, your intention, your aim, what you're going to. Not so much the particular goal, but the theme behind your actions, the body, speech, mind. That's why you can call it motivation, intention, thought, inclination. But not a particular thought. That's why it's like a group of thoughts, a group of inclinations, a group of motivations and plans, which are nekama, which is like letting go, renouncing, giving up, letting go. Which is why I said at first, we don't meditate to get something. We meditate to renounce, to give up things. Imagine you've got a present for that's your birthday. And like happens with many presents, sometimes I've had this when people give me some pericure. They wrap it in brown paper, just relaxing. And then I open up that brown paper, and then it's got the wrapping from the shop. You meditate to abandon things. You meditate to abandon the hindrances. You meditate to abandon craving, passion. Because when those things are gone, then all that's left is the jhana. The jhana is like a base state. So you don't try and get there, you try and get rid of the obstacles. Imagine you've got a present for your birthday. And like happens with many presents, sometimes I've had this when people give me some pericure. They wrap it in brown paper, just relaxing. And then I open up that brown paper, and then it's got the wrapping from the shop. You've got to unwrap that, and then it's got a box. So you take it out of the box, and then it's some more plastic wrapping. Inside that plastic wrapping, there's some more paper wrapping. so many wrappings and writings these days. But right inside, you find the person you need, say, there's some tea or something. That's the same with the jhana. The jhana is right inside of this moment. You have the jhana right now. It's wrapped up in so many covering. And that's why the path of meditation is taking the wrappings off. First of all, taking the wrapping of time away. So there's no more perception of time, it's just present moment. Taking the wrapping of thinking off. Unwrapping thinking so it's all gone. And then taking the wrapping of the five senses off. So there's no more five senses. And then taking off the wrapping of will, of doing things. And then when all those have disappeared, what you've got left is the jhanas. That's why it's a wonderful thing to understand. You don't attain the jhanas, you reveal the jhanas. They're there already, you've just got to let go of the obstacles which are between you and those of the parents. So you meditate to let go, to renounce, to give up, to unwrap at this moment. Let's try and get some other jhanas. So understand that's makeup. Yes? Yeah, this is a very good one. I'll mention that now since you brought it up. I was going to mention it another time, but a lotus, this is using a very, very famous mantra, which everybody knows from Vajrayana, the old Manikarmic book. And all that really means, I don't even the Tibetans know what it means, but the Thai Bosmans know what it means. It means like you're worshipping or homage to the jewel, which is the mani, in the heart of the lotus, in the padma. Now, we have padma, it's a very common name in Sri Lanka. This is the lotus. So it's like a reverence, a worship to the jewel in the lotus. What is the jewel in the lotus? And the symbol of the lotus, as you would all know, is the lotus flower closes up at night time. When it closes up at night time, in the early morning sunshine, when it starts, the sun starts to heat or warm the outermost petal, when the outermost layer of petals opens up to reveal the next layer of petals, and then that layer of petals can also receive the heat of the sun, and that opens up to reveal the next layer of petals. Layer after layer opens up in turn. And as you know with the lotus, the outermost petals, because it has to endure the wind and the dust, is always very coarse and not particularly beautiful. But as that outermost covering opens up, the next layer of petals is more refined and more beautiful and more fragrant. The deeper you go into the lotus, the more subtle, the more fragrant and beautiful are those petals. They're the innermost ones. And as you go into the innermost petals, they're just so wonderful, so delightful, so beautiful, until you may be able to go into the heart, the center of that lotus. This is actually like going into the body and the mind in meditation. Whatever you're experiencing now, it may be very rough, like the outermost petals of the lotus, because your ordinary body and mind has to endure everyday life. But if you just use the sunshine of mindfulness, you just watch without moving, then this moment opens up, or rather your life opens up into the present moment. You get that first stage, the first layer of petals inside the outermost one. Is present moment awareness. You keep focusing on that and that opens up into the silence. You keep focusing on that and that opens up into the breath. That opens up into the full awareness of the breath. In the middle of the full awareness of the breath becomes a beautiful breath. And soon that opens up into this amazing nimitta. You're going through very, very refined petals. And right in the middle of the nimitta, that opens up to reveal the first jhana. In the middle of the first jhana, to find the second jhana. Going all the way in, until in the middle of the fourth Aruta state. When that opens up, there you get what's called the Aruta Samapatti. There you find what's the jewel in the heart of the lotus, which is nirvana, which is cessation. So it's a very beautiful simile of opening up the lotus. And the point is that in any lotus, the jewel is right in the center at all times. You may look at that dirty old lotus and think that's nothing because the outside does look rough and coarse. In the same, whatever person you are, no matter whether you're tired or restless, you've had a terrible day today or a wonderful day today, it doesn't matter because at all times today, right in that center of each moment, there has been the bond. We need to unwrap the moment. We need to actually open up that lotus. And the way we open up is by just keeping mindfulness still. If the sun moves to another lotus, very quickly it closes up. By that I mean if the clouds come over, so the sun can't warm the lotus, then it closes again. So your job is to keep mindfulness still. Constantly just watching this moment, no matter what it is, and you find it opens up closer. That's what I mean by the path of meditation is going in. It's never going on. In this meditation, you never go on to the next stage of meditation. You always go in to the next stage. And that's not just being pedantic, which is meant like being clever. It's a very, you don't go to the next place. You go deeper into where you are now. Unwrapping, going in a bit further, going into the lotus of this moment. So you never throw away whatever you're experiencing. Just go deeper into it. And that's part of the meditation. So never think that, you know, you're doing no good. Or you have to go and try something else. Whatever you're experiencing, just go to its center. Go deeper into it. And you'll find there is a peace. Go deeper into that peace, and you'll find even more peace. Go deeper into that more peace. And go into the lotus. Into the center. There's another question here. Please also explain going to past and future, creating a will and craving. If usually in the past, you need something of the past to have ill will. Because ill will is to something somebody did or something which happened. In this present moment, it's already here. We can't really do much about it. But what happens, you have this moment, it can be a pain. It's the next moment, so I don't like that thing. You find ill will is always the next moment, looking back at a moment which has already happened. In the present moment, if you really get close to the center of this thing we call time, ill will just can't exist. Nor can craving. This craving is for some hope for the future, some desire for a more peaceful meditation, for a nimitta, for a jhana. When we have that longing for something in the future, again the lotus can't open up because we're not looking in the right place. The present moment, just now, ill will and craving mostly disappears. So by going to the present moment, you're doing a huge amount to stop the hindrances. All the suffering is being overcome just by being present. And you're focusing on what you have now. All idea of what you might have in the future is gone. So all hope and all craving is gone. And you don't look upon the past. You know, just how terribly you meditated today. Or how hopeless you will be. Just how a waste of time it's been. You get ill will towards yourself and the place and everything else. If you don't look at the past, there's no ill will there. So that's what I mean by the present moment overcomes 99% of craving and ill will. It's a wonderful start for meditation. It's not that difficult to do. So that's the first question. You just paid him 45 minutes. Question number two. Oh, no, that's the third question. Avijja is no knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. Is there more to it than that in terms of cause of it or effect of it? Avijja. It's a great saying by the Buddha. It's because of not understanding the Four Noble Truths, that we're not so ones. We keep getting reborn. So how many of you know the Four Noble Truths? You could probably recite them in Pali. But does that mean you're all so ones? What the Buddha actually said is like completely understanding the Four Noble Truths. And that's that word, it's called parinyaya, to be fully known, completely, all around known. And the point is that with the Four Noble Truths, say even the first truth of dukkha, here we know that many things in life are dukkha. Husbands are dukkha, wives are dukkha, the body is dukkha. Watching cricket is dukkha. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. There's many things we know are obviously dukkha. There's some things which we think, no, that dukkha doesn't really apply to those. It's the places where we don't apply dukkha is what means we don't fully see dukkha. And sometimes, especially Western Buddhists, they think, oh yeah, you can understand that some of life is suffering, but if you're wise and if you actually are skillful, you don't have to have suffering anymore. You can have a happy marriage. You know about marriage, the stories of marriage, they say that when you fall in love, they say that love is blind. You ever heard that saying, love is blind? Yes, so that means that marriage is an institution for the blind. Why are you laughing? It's true, that's why you're laughing. All the other jokes about marriage. A man told his best friend, well, before we got married, I used to hold my girlfriend's hand out of love. Now we're married, I hold her hand out of self-defense. So there's lots of places we don't apply. So what Avijja is, instead of like ignorance or not knowledge, I prefer the word like delusion. I'm using like a psychology word. Where what is really suffering we take to be happiness. What is happiness we take to be suffering. And sometimes people look at me living a monastic life and say, there must be so much suffering, you know, living in a monastery, not having any sex, not being able to watch TV, not being able to, you know, do this or do that. But it's not, it's so much happiness having few possessions and being free of all these things. Wonderful saying of the Buddha, what the noble ones say is happiness, the world says is suffering. What the world says is suffering, the noble ones say is happiness. It's a wonderful little saying. Because what is, in many places, what is one of the most delightful experiences? What people say is the birth of your first son or first daughter. And as soon as a child is born, you take it around to see all the relations, and you're so proud of your young child. What does a child think? As soon as a child is born, it cries. The child's not happy. What happens when a person dies? And when you look inside that coffin, the person who dies is usually smiling. But everyone else is crying. We get it the wrong way around. When people are born, we should cry with the baby. When people die, we should smile with the corpse. So it is a bit. Sometimes it's make-believe. And in my books, I'm quite hard-hitting when it gets to romance. Because even here in Colombo, you know, the young men, the young girls who are looking for a partner, where do they go to find romance? They go to nightclubs, or they go to, say, candlelit restaurants, isn't that romantic? Or they may go for a walk in the park under the moonlight. These are the romantic places. know why they're romantic? Because they're so dark, you can't really see what you're going out with. So your imagination can play all sorts of tricks on you. But that guy is the hunkiest guy in the whole Colombo. And that girl is like Angelina Jolie. Because that's what happens when you can't see clearly. As many people have noticed, no one ever falls in love at midday in the full sunlight. So why is it that we do this? It's because we want the romance, because of delusion. It's make-believe. That's what delusion is. But we want to believe. This is the problem. That's why I read this. Wishful thinking. So, the way to overcome delusion. It's interesting that sometimes I say, what's the cause of delusion? When we had dependent origination, and put it never went before delusion, but in another sutra, we say, well, let's not call it the cause of delusion, let's call it the fuel of delusion. What fuels our ichha are the five differences. That's the fuel of delusion. So the more you overcome and suppress the five differences, the more you starve delusion. And you starve it and starve it and starve it until you become so weak you can see through its depths. And by starving the five differences, that's where you get the insights which sooner or later can really overcome delusion. We have great fun in the West talking about the delusion of a self. The delusion of suffering is one thing. When you talk about the idea of self or a soul or me or mine, that's always great fun. Because the scientists and the psychologists, they usually find it right. This is one very famous experiment which was done by Professor Benjamin Libet, L-I-B-E-T. A very simple experiment where the subjects of the experiment were watching a clock, and whenever they wanted to, they would just flex their wrist, noting down the time they would flex their wrist. At the same time, they had some gizmo on their brain to measure what's known as the readiness potential, because just before there's some movement of the body, there's a part of the brain lights up. You can actually tell when the brain initiates a movement. And they want to find out whether what we take to be intention, that we notice now I decide to move my wrist, whether that happens before the readiness potential or afterwards. And what Benjamin Libet found out, which really shocked other people, is that the brain lights up first, then we form the intention, then we move. So what we take to be intention or will, it's not the beginning of the process, which is actually part of the process. Once we decide, it's already been decided for us. It is delusion that we think we're in control. When you decided to move just now, Sheila, you can notice you decided that intention which occurred, which you can be mindful of. By that time, it's already too late, you can stop it. I remember seeing this when I was a student at Cambridge. I joined many societies. One of the wonderful things about life at university in those days is that the coursework was not that demanding. The amount of time you spent in lectures and doing your work was only a fraction of the time you spent in college. You were expected to go to other courses. You know, to things you'd never get examined on, to get a wide education. There were many societies and clubs in the evening to expand your understanding and knowledge. One of those societies was the Buddhist Society, a Buddhist club at Cambridge, where I started my interest in Dhamma. Well, two of the other societies I joined, one was the Astronomical Society, but the other one was the Psychic Research Society, where we started investigating ghosts and all weird, exciting stuff. And every year, a hypnotist would come and do a demonstration for us. And the hypnotist was always good fun. Because being students, we'd all volunteer to be hypnotized. Good sports. And fortunately for my reputation, I was not a good hypnotic subject. Because the person chosen would always be humiliated. And I remember this Welsh father with four young students, like many others, volunteered. And he was a wonderful hypnotic subject. Very quickly, the hypnotist put him into a very deep trance and made him do some ridiculous things, which was hilarious for a bunch of students. Yeah, we laughed ourselves silly. But the most important part of the demonstration was that the hypnotist told the student, in trance, he told the student that when I touch my right earlobe, you will stand up and sing the British national anthem, God Save the Queen, in full, in a loud voice. And then he took him out of trance. And the poor student went to his seat. We knew the command, but the poor student didn't know because he was told on hypnosis. And we couldn't wait for this hypnotist to touch his right ear. But he was a bit of an entertainer because now and again he'd move his hand to his ear and then take it away again, just to keep us excited. But eventually he touched his right ear. And during talking about something else, this little student immediately stood up and started singing, God Save Us, in a loud voice. And it was hilarious. We all broke up laughing and cracking up. And all our laughter never stopped this young man. He continued to dance to the end. It was one of the most funny things to see. But the most important part was when the hypnotist, when we all hung down, he asked this young man, why did you do that? And this young man gave a good reason. It became clear to everybody in the lecture theatre that that man thought he decided to sing. He could not distinguish between his own free will or what he had to be free will and what was clearly a command from a hypnotist. What you think is free will, your choice, what moved you, what made you come here, what makes you speak or choose this particular food or that particular food. It's not you doing this at all. It's part of the whole process. Sometimes when I say that, people get very afraid or very upset. That's not true. Science is there. The Dhamma is there. You are not in control. But the delusion is that, yes, I'm in control. I'm going to do the dance. I'm going to work hard these next few days. You're not. So that's delusion. The delusion of will. Delusion of self. For me, for mine.